Calling State Affairs to order at 3:04 p.m. Tuesday, March 30, 2021, in the Max Grunberg Room. We have four members present: Representatives Vance, Story, Klayman, and myself, Chair Christ Tompkins. And with four members present, we have a quorum to conduct business. This is nice to have our first full normal State Affairs hearing since the closeout of finance subcommittees. And let the record reflect: Representative Kaufman joined us at 3:04 p.m. Per usual, thanks to Sophia and House Records and Tom in the back of the room with LIO for facilitating today's meeting. And I'm going to ironically make this housekeeping note when everybody else has arrived, but it's about attendance. So we'll save that for when we're at 7 of 7. And we have two items on today's agenda: House Bill 137, a first hearing from Representative Fields, former co-chair of this August committee. We're having withdrawal, though. You know, you're welcome back anytime. And then also House Bill 63, also a first hearing from Speaker Stutes relating to the Alaska Marine Highway System. So we'll start with House Bill 137. And Representative Fields and Mr. Walsh, feel free to come forward. And before we dive into the PowerPoint and the bill introduction, there's a CS in the offing. Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 137, version 32-LS0650/B, Bullard, Dunmire, 32921, as our working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Very quickly, Mr. Walsh or Representative Fields, how does the CS differ from the original version?
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields. The committee substitute before you corrects an inadvertent drafting error. We did not mean to preclude public partnerships where they may exist in the future.
Very well. Thank you. With that, I'll lift my objection, remove my objection. Any further objection to adoption of the CS? Seeing none, the CS version backslash B is adopted as the working document for the committee, and that takes us to the bill before the committee. Representative Fields.
Thanks. For the record, Zach Fields. I really appreciate the committee hearing this bill. House Bill 137 effectively keeps our existing DMVs open. As I think committee members are aware, the Department of Administration proposed closing them in six communities where there's really not a viable DMV nearby, which would either lead to very long trips for Alaskans to access these essential services or force them to pay more. So House Bill 137 is written to keep DMVs open in communities of 850 people or more, which effectively would keep these six existing DMVs open. And it's written that way because we aren't allowed to do, I think it's special and local statutes, so we can't just list the communities, but we can have a reasonable population threshold, and that's how the bill works. So why do DMVs matter? People drive to work. In terms of Alaskans supporting themselves, they need to be able to drive to work. Of course, for folks who drive trucks, commercial driver license are important. You get those at a DMV. Most Alaskans who commute by themselves in vehicles. As we know, some Alaskans commute fairly long distances, whether it's from the Matsu Valley to Anchorage or in the interior. And I think we've all seen in a far-flung state how trucks are important to transport in the rail belt. So just a little bit of data about commercial traffic and the economy in places like Skagway and in the Tok Delta Junction Fairbanks corridor. By allowing Alaskans to obtain CDLs, DMVs help ensure safe passage of billions of dollars of commercial goods and a very significant amount of freight that enters the state on the road system. And of course, for freight that enters through the port, DMVs are important for helping get that freight to places of business where consumers can access it. I think of the DMV as a place where I've gotten a driver's license and bought and sold boats and things like that, but just wanted to put a longer list of DMV functions up here to show how comprehensive they are and how important they are for Alaskans, whether it's just in terms of personal mobility or in terms of someone's job. And it's important to note that while it is possible to outsource some functions and charge a lot more for them, there are some functions that can't be offered or that are much more inconvenient to offer through a private facility. So in a place like Anchorage, we have both DMVs and private facilities, and it's not my intent in this bill to restrict entrepreneurs from opening private facilities that offer some DMV services, but I think it's important to recognize there are certain services that only the DMV offers or that only the DMV offers economically. So what does the DMV do? Original issue of driver's licenses, updates at age 21, renewal of driver's license for seniors, which I would note needs to be in person for people of a certain age, original issue and renewal of commercial driver's licenses. As we approach a new October 1 deadline for Real ID, the DMVs are really important for Real IDs. And, you know, I know the legislature has looked extensively at the issue of Real ID and people's access to medical care. You know, basically where you have to travel in some cases to get medical care, the Real ID is a real life or death issue. Test taking, vehicle transfers, you know, important in seaside communities for things like buying a boat, which might be one's occupation. VIN inspections, name change, marriage, divorce, handicap parking sticker. DMVs do a lot, and I think as committee members are aware, they do not net cost money to the state of Alaska. They recoup these costs and fees. I think when you look at the fees DMVs charge, they're actually very efficient to conduct these services. And some of the folks at the Department of Administration over the last series of years, the professional staff there have done really good work to make DMV operation more efficient and serve a really large number of people economically and keep those fees low. So I'm going to see if this animation can work here. Just wanted to lay out, if we were to close DMVs in places like Tok, what's the alternative? Places like Delta Junction. It's a long drive up the Alcan from Tok to Fairbanks. If you're lucky in dry weather, you know, maybe a little under 2 hours. Obviously, if it's blowing snow, it can take a lot longer. It can be a real safety issue. You know, thinking about the different, you know, going from Tok to Glen Allen, thinking about driving from Valdez to Glen Allen to access DMV services, obviously that goes over Thompson Pass, which is sometimes inaccessible in the winter. You know, the proposed closure of a DMV in Haines to me is really mind-boggling. Are we going to require people to ride a ferry for multiple hours at a cost of hundreds of dollars when the ferry service itself has been cut back so much? I mean, that just seems nonsensical. I'm also baffled by the proposal to close a DMV in Homer and make people drive to Soldotna. Obviously a busy road a lot of the time when you have summer traffic, a dangerous drive in certain winter conditions, and just an inconvenience that's entirely unnecessary when, again, these are facilities where the costs in the system are recouped by fees. Now, the closest DMV that's been proposed for closure is in Eagle River, and there is a DMV in Midtown Anchorage. And I guess I would just note, why would we be closing the DMV in Eagle River when you're forcing people onto a road that at rush hour can have very prolonged traffic jams? In the winter, it's not unusual to have really serious accidents where, you know, a drive that would normally take 20 minutes might take 4 hours. So, again, for a service that is funded by fees, why would we close that down? Why would we inconvenience Alaskans and inhibit commerce? So there we go. to the point of the absurdity of making people drive from Valdez to Glen Allen, just a couple of photos from Thompson Pass 2014, obviously some of the most extreme weather of any roadway on earth, and we shouldn't be closing down the DMV in Valdez. It just doesn't make any sense. Here's some photos, Delta Junction in the interior. Again, why are we going to make people drive hundreds of miles for a service that should be available in what in Alaska are fairly large communities? There's been some discussion what services could be executed online. I think there are two issues here. Number one, DMVs serve all Alaskans whether or not they have internet. Not everyone has internet. As you see from the right-hand part of this slide, a very large percentage of people don't have internet, particularly seniors who, like I said, have to visit the DMVs to renew their licenses in person. It's also important to note that internet options aren't going to work for things like getting your real ID, your driver's knowledge test, your vision test, CDL services. So we're talking about a large population of Alaska seniors. I know I've heard from a large number of seniors urging that we keep these DMVs open. And actually, I want to turn to my staff for a moment about this issue of vision testing. The administration had suggested that, you know, we could just have people go to doctors to have their vision tested. They don't need to do that at a DMV, and that really doesn't work, but I want to turn to my staff, Tristan Walsh, for a fuller explanation of why that is not a viable alternative.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff representative Fields, vision tests, especially for those over age 69, are not necessarily going to be easily available for a senior's insurance plan, and we do have an expert witness here later after the presentation who can speak to some of the issues that the seniors he represents face. And so those are services that are currently offered in the local DMVs themselves to residents.
And if you can identify yourself.
Sure. Back to Zach Fields. So in some of these communities, the administration said, ooh, we can just shift this to the private sector. Sure, for some functions, important to note, not all, for some functions, there may be private vendors. Unfortunately, they charge a lot more money for the same services. And for something like the DMV that is supported by fees, that is self-sufficient, I guess I would just ask, why would we double costs on Alaskans for what in some cases are documents necessary to have a job? I have no problem with private vendors complementing DMVs, and that happens in Anchorage where, you know, there's a UMV down on Abbott Road, and if people in the Abbott Loop area want to go to the UMV instead of driving to Midtown and, you know, pay $20 more for a registration duplicate, I think that's a good option for a consumer. That is very different from replacing a DMV with a UMV in a community like Homer. So we've seen several proposals in the last couple years that are a little baffling when we look at this issue of fee-funded services and what actually saves money for the state of Alaska. Really important to note, the DMV pays for itself. And actually, each of the six proposed locations has been revenue positive for the state. So why would we close them if these facilities are paying for themselves, as the whole system is paying for itself? And I guess I would just note, you know, this is a little bit analogous to the Postal Service. I would say if it cost a little bit more to send a letter to Ukiagvik and a little bit less in Anchorage, I'm okay with that. That's a system thing. You know, the Postal Service sustains commerce, it sustains communication. If maybe there was a DMV in a rural community that didn't quite pay for itself, I don't accept the premise that we should automatically close it down. But even if you don't agree with that premise, these DMVs actually do pay for themselves. So why would we close them? You know, why at a time when a lot of Alaskans are reentering the workplace, maybe trying to pay down debt that might have built up during the pandemic, why would we deepen economic divides by making it harder to access basic documents that are necessary to commute to work, to drive a truck, or in the case of seniors, to remain connected in their community? Just want to quote Seniors of Alaska as an organization that's weighed in terms of keeping DMVs open, and they conducted a poll that found very strong support for keeping DMVs open. I think a lot of us have personally experienced how important it is for seniors to be connected to their family members, their loved ones, their friends, and, you know, being connected in most of our communities in Alaska means being able to drive somewhere. So absolutely important for people's mental health and ability to maintain those social connections. So it's not only economic considerations that are at play here. Thanks again for the opportunity to be here and to hear this bill.
Thank you, Representative Fields. And let the record reflect that Representative Eastman joined us at 3:07 p.m. and Representative Tarr joined us at 3:09 p.m. Would you prefer we go to invited testimony now and then open it up for questions?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay.
Whatever you prefer.
So the sole invited testifier for House Bill 137 is Peter Zoyas, Executive Director of Senior Citizens of Alaska. Mr. Zoyas, if you can hear us, please put yourself on record and present your invited testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman Chris Tompkins and committee members. My name is Peter Zoyas, and I represent the Seniors of Alaska, a nonprofit which supports House Bill 137, sponsored by Representative Zach Fields. The Department of Administration was proposing to close six DMV offices in communities across rural Alaska and leaving them with no DMV office or only a private vendor DMV that would charge arbitrary fees over and above state fees. Our reading of HB 137 is pretty straightforward. It recognizes the needs of rural Alaska communities and the community necessity and reliance on a state DMV. The state DMV is an integral part of many rural communities, from its presence to its culture and community membership. The workers in these offices are part of the fabric and energy of each community. What would a state DMV closure mean for Alaska's senior, disabled, rural, lower income, and Native Alaska residents? Residents of rural communities would have limited or no access to a state DMV. Although a private partnership may arrive in a community, the convenience fee structure presents an economic and discriminatory hardship on seniors and other community members. For example, seniors in Valdez would be forced to pay at least twice as much for mandated state services as seniors in other areas. That is outrageous and discriminatory. Fortunately, the idea was unanimously rejected by the House Finance Subcommittee. Several of you voted to reject the budget proposal to close rural DMV offices. However, the Department of Administration is currently under no obligation to listen to the legislature, and it has made that clear. Former Commissioner Chewbacca testified that as a courtesy, she would respect the legislature's decision, but noted that the commissioner is not obligated to follow it, and that the Department of Administration commissioner may respect the vote that had the authority to change the budget at will. And we do not know what a new commissioner will, quote, respect. House Bill 137 addresses that issue and exercises the legislature's legitimate authority to overrule state DMV offices and their funding. Last week, the House Finance Subcommittee, of which several of you are members, voted unanimously to reject the closure of six rural DMV offices in the fiscal year 2022 budget. HB 137 is necessary to protect that vote and rural DMV facilities statewide by making rural DMV closures require legislative approval versus an unchallenged departmental decision. I have had the opportunity to speak with civic leaders and concerned seniors in Homer, Tote, Haines, Double Junction, Valdez, and Eagle River. They all support the intent and protection that HB 137 affords their community. Rural community leaders know there are no regulations or protections from an unregulated DMV private partner pricing, and they know the state cannot easily replace a private partner when it decides to close. If we're the only DMV location in a community enclosed, residents would be forced to drive hundreds of miles to obtain mandated state services. If we're the only DMV in the community, residents would be at the mercy of unregulated convenience fees. Many state representatives and state senators support HB 137, with senators looking forward to seeing the final submission. HB 137 is a nonpartisan bill that demonstrates the legislators of the last frontier understand and care for all rural Alaskans, including its senior population. For senior citizens, the closure of access to a state DMV subjects them to a number of negative impacts and discriminatory practices, including unnecessary travel. When HB 137 is adopted, other measures to improve DMV access to the general public will be more amenable. The retention of a state DMV in rural communities will allow for realistic simplification concepts. The legislature has the ability and, yes, the duty and obligation to protect its residents from abuse and discrimination from the unintended consequences of unfettered administrative actions. HB 137 gives you, the Alaska legislature, the control and ability to honor your obligation. Simply put, passing 137, you take the legislative authority to protect and maintain the access of your constituents to state-mandated DMV requirements, a legislative authority that you own. With no nearby DMV, residents would be required to travel many miles by car or ferry to require mandated state obligations at great expense. Online driver license renewals for seniors over 69 has been touted as a solution. There's a solution to a problem that does not exist. Seniors do not object to DMV visits. They do object to unregulated fees, discrimination, and undue travel. This past week, Cities of Alaska has heard from over 1,000 local area residents and seniors asking that access to the state DMV be permanent. An informal 24-hour poll conducted by Cities of Alaska yielded an astonishing 15-9 support for HB 137. Most locales at 100% and overall at 96.5%. Clearly a vote in confidence to you, the legislators. Opposing public statements like, you only need an in-person visit once in a lifetime, and there are only five reasons to visit a DMV, are questionable. For example, first-time license, update your license at 21, marriage, real ID, divorce, lost title, every other time renewal, commercial transactions, and at least a dozen more make it clear that the once-in-a-lifetime or five reasons are rhetoric, not factual. Rural Alaska communities and their senior residents need the protection that HB 137 provides. The former DOA commissioner testified publicly.
Mr. Zoides, if you could wrap up your testimony in the next minute or so, okay. That way we can open it up for questions.
The former commissioner testified publicly on behalf to this House and Senate that it's the job of you, the legislature, to listen to and act on behalf of the people. DOA merely processes data and data points. One more minute. You, the legislature, represent and speak for the people of Alaska. Senator Alaska submits that you be the ones who determine the needs of our rural communities. Again, please vote yes on 137 and protect Alaska's seniors and rural communities from unfiltered, discriminatory, or cold data point-driven actions. The House Finance Subcommittee voted unanimous against closing the state DMVs. That vote will lose its value and its meaning without a positive vote to protect it, now and in the future, with passage of HB 137. You are the representatives people elected, and your constituents overwhelmingly support HB 137. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zoides. With that concludes the bill introduction with remarks from the sponsor as well as invited testimony. Other questions from the committee regarding House Bill 137? Representative Eastman.
My question would be to the sponsor.
Absolutely. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'm curious, I see in page one, you've got the number 850, and I'm wondering, you know, how you came to 850.
Thanks, through the chair. We are prohibited from doing local and specific legislation, so it would be impermissible for us to say, you know what, we think we should have a DMV in Haines, but forget about the other communities. So I think if we're going to contemplate establishing a reasonable threshold for community size that should have basic services like a DMV, We have to pick a reasonable and consistent population threshold statewide. So I looked at where DMVs have operated historically, where they seem to have broad support, where there's a need, and looked at the size of communities and our population distribution. So 850 is a best guess for a, you know, what in Alaska is a fairly large rural community. So you have to set a threshold somewhere, and it has to be consistent. And I thought that that seemed like a fair one. And it does have the effect of protecting all existing DMVs.
Follow-up?
Follow-up. So I am, you may not be aware, I have a number of communities in my district that would meet the 850 threshold. But despite being the second largest district in the state, we don't have a single DMV office. And so I'm just wondering, since we're passing a statute protecting DMVs in, you know, the various places where they exist, and we're setting the threshold 850, I have to imagine there'd be some folks in my district that would be complaining, why are we passing a law which seems to have a local effect, which deprives my community of that privilege?
Right. Yeah, thanks through the chair. To be clear, we're not prohibiting the state from opening additional DMVs, and I hope our state grows and we do open additional DMVs. It's a floor, not a ceiling. And it also does not prohibit, like I said, complementary private services. But, you know, just thinking about the Mat-Su Valley, I mean, if the Department of Administration is able to open a DMV in Talkeetna and thinks that people shouldn't have to drive, you know, 2.5 hours, my view would be more power to them. And as the valley continues to grow, I could see a need to have potentially multiple DMVs, you know, in Wasilla and Palmer. And that would, to me, would be a very reasonable thing to consider, and this bill would permit it, but it would not be so restrictive as to require it.
Other questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you. I'm allowing others, since I'm always first to raise my hand, I'm allowing others to have the opportunity, because I do have many questions. And If I'm reading the bill correctly, it prohibits any future contracts with private partnerships for DMV services. And am I reading that? Is that the intent of this bill?
Through the chair, no. It doesn't prohibit future private partnerships. What it does require is maintaining a public facility, the DMV remaining open in those communities where it's already open. If private entrepreneurs want to go out there and open additional private services, they can do that. And I think, as we've seen in a lot of communities, there's a market for that. But we just want to protect the core access to public services. And my staff has more to add to that.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, through the chair, Representative Vance, our understanding of the language as currently constructed would also not preclude the renewal of existing contracts. So those that are currently partners would be able to continue to renew those contracts.
Follow up.
As it reads, it says the department may not close or contract with a private person in a partnership on January 1st, 21 in a community with a population of 850 persons or more. So it gives the appearance that it is not allowing the private sector partnerships moving forward. And that's a great concern of mine, because it seems that they have provided a great service in our communities. And I was wondering if you know how many private partnerships the DMV currently has across the state.
I have heard about private partnerships in many communities. And when I submitted the Ledge legal drafting request, I was very clear with them that the purpose here is to preserve existing public DMVs while continuing to allow private sector operators to open potentially additional or continue existing private sector operations that complement but do not replace public sector DMVs. So I'm not a lawyer, and I didn't draft the bill because I'm not Ledge legal, but I think it is drafted to meet that intent, and my staff may add more on that.
For the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields. Through the chair, Representative Vance, our understanding is that there are approximately 15 currently private partners in the state. That is subject to some bit of fluctuation given the date and time you are looking. The current website does not have a couple locations that appear to have been changed since last year. So that's based on the subcommittee's process that you discussed with the department.
Follow up. Again, there's no language in here that would provide a grandfather statute to the contracted services that would be a concern, and I think that we should look into that because there could be related jobs that are affected and services that, if those contracts were to have to end, that the state would then be obligated to provide those in small communities and create a very large fiscal note during this time of uncertainty. And so that is something that I think definitely needs to be looked at. Further question is, I'm struggling to see the need for this bill when our votes opposing the closure of the DMVs was made very clear. And by putting this in statute, it limits our ability each year to be able to assess the needs of the state and have that flexibility of providing the most efficient government.
Right. Through the chair, first, the previous statement, the bill definitely does not require closure of any private DMVs. It doesn't cut off renewal. All it does is protect those DMVs in communities where they already exist based on an 850 population threshold. We've had extensive conversations with Ledge Legal about it. I'm 100% confident that the bill meets the intent as written in terms of the need for the bill. Around the time we introduced the bill, the former commissioner said that she would not be closing down DMVs pending input from the legislature, and the finance subcommittee on which the chairman sits did some good work to make it very clear the legislature supports keeping these DMVs open. However, I received an email today from the mayor of Homer saying thank you for introducing HB 137. Unfortunately, our local DMV office was closed last Friday. So, you know, I think that just illustrates the commissioner said one thing and did another. We need to keep these DMVs open. We need to pass this bill. I just think it's preposterous to suggest that the community as large as Homer shouldn't have a local DMV. I mean, there, as the Homer City Council said in a resolution endorsing keeping the DMVs open, 13,000 people live in that region. I mean, that's just a lot of people in the state of Alaska. They should have access to a local DMV.
Final follow-up, Representative Vance.
Yes. Have you inquired as to why the Homer DMV has been shut down?
Well, I think the commission, through the chair, I think the commissioner made it pretty clear that she wanted to close down these six DMVs. She falsely stated that they cost money. They don't. They're revenue positive, and that was the department administration's stated reason. Maybe they're going to reassess now that there's going to be a different commissioner, but I think they made their intent and reasons very clear.
Representative Vance, we'll have the opportunity to circle back to you, but I just want to move over to Representative Klayman in the queue.
For larger communities, Juneau, Anchorage, Fairbanks, all those communities just have one DMV office?
Well, the municipality of Anchorage has multiple. I'm only aware of one in what people think of as the core of Anchorage, that is in Midtown. I'm going to defer to Tristan for more here.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure.
Representative Klayman, through the chair, Tristan Walsh, staff representative Fields. In the larger metropolitan areas in Alaska, typically there is a state-run DMV, and in most of those metropolitan areas there is one or two or more private partners, but typically the state-run location, there's only one in each one of those core areas.
And this is Zach Fields again for the record. Through the chair, I do want to follow up on this because this was an issue that we talked to Ledge Legal about this at drafting. So community in this bill is very clearly written to differentiate the community of Eagle River from the community of Anchorage, because notwithstanding that it is within the municipality of Anchorage, it is important for that local community to have a DMV. In the same way that you could have a very large borough like the Matsu Borough, and you know, should the state establish multiple DMVs at opposite ends of the Matsu Borough to serve a growing population center, I would say that would be logical as well. So in drafting with Ledge Legal, I told them to be very clear. I don't want the Department of Administration to be able to construe this so that they only have to have a DMV in Anchorage or a DMV in the Matsu Borough. It's by community.
Follow up, Representative Clayman.
So the intent of the bill specific to the Anchorage and Eagle River example is that this would mean that the DMV could not close the Eagle River office. They would have to leave them both open, keep them both open indefinitely.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, I'm reading the first section there, section one, and I'm wondering if it could, if some event occurred which caused the population to fall, could we get into a circumstance where, because the date of operation with a set population, and then if that population fell, are we still set by the date? Could, I mean, this is Alaska and things can happen.
Thanks, through the chair, things change. My intention in setting a population threshold was that in the very unfortunate event that, you know, everyone moves from Tok to Delta Junction, that the department would have the flexibility of closing down the DMV in Tok. It would be absurd to keep a DMV open in a community where people no longer resided, and it does get back to, you know, this population threshold issue. We should choose one that has some basis. So that was my intent in requesting that threshold.
Follow up.
Thank you. I guess I'm still just staring at it, making sure that there's not a language trap there. That
And I'd be happy. I don't know if Ledge Legal is online, but it was certainly my intent to establish a population threshold and not kind of keep all DMVs open based on an arbitrary point of time in 2021.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, and through the chair. I'm curious. I know there's quite a few parts of the state that don't currently have a local DMV. I know there's, you know, probably the vast majority of villages fall into that category. How do they, you know, solve that problem currently?
Thank you, through the chair. That is a great question, Representative Eastman. I remember a few years ago, as I recall, when the state closed down a DMV and what was then named Barrow, currently Ukiagvik, and basically the answer when that happens is there are all these stakeholders who are affected, and local groups try to piece together services that as best as possible mirror what a DMV does. And you know, as I recall, and it was a few years ago, I worked at the State Department of Labor when the state closed down the Barrow DMV. The decision of an agency I worked for, I didn't agree with it, but that prolonged process and the inability to perfectly replicate DMV functions and the massive inconvenience that it caused for a rural community definitely informed my view on this bill. And it would be my hope that, you know, looking at the net positive revenue situation for our DMVs, the state would consider offering services where people live, especially in remote rural communities where you really don't have great alternatives. If these are fee-supported functions of government that are necessary for people to have jobs, why wouldn't we provide them where people live? But that is beyond the scope of the bill, the issue of you know, extending DMV services to new communities.
Follow up.
Thank you, and follow up to the chair. So I'm also just trying to remember, you know, where else in statute I've seen similar requirements for you know, that the state is required to have certain offices. And one of them that does come to mind is the statute that says that, you know, being able to file your APOC paperwork is really important. And I think we have in statute that there's a requirement for a physical APOC office in every Senate district, which means I think in about at least 18 Senate districts, we're violating the law currently. And I think that's always been the case. And I'm just wondering if maybe we can learn from that and not make that same mistake again. I mean, how do you make someone not close an office, I guess? Can't they always just say, kind of like with APOC, well,
We'd love to have offices everywhere, but we don't have enough money.
Yeah. Thanks. Through the chair, I guess we do rely on our commissioners following the law, and you know, if they fail to follow the law, then the question is who has standing to take it to court and enforce it. With respect to APOC, obviously a little different in terms of function of the agency and services provided, but I think that most commissioners do do their best to follow the law.
I think on that point, and it could be helpful to have any insight or clarity from legislative legal, if this bill were to pass, I imagine if the city of Haines or whatever community found its DMV to have closed, even with passage of this law, they could bring suit, and I would assume have a pretty good case. Similarly, if the city of Sitka wanted to sue the state because there's not an APOC office in our Senate district right now, they probably also would have a pretty good case. But I think it's just that maybe no community cares enough to do it. But I think the point that you're making is well taken and sort of applies to other areas of law and policy as well. Follow-up?
Yes, so follow-up. So are you concerned that if the state, the legislature in particular, begins a process of passing a bill like this requiring that buildings not close, are you concerned that that might negatively impact the decision-making process when the state goes to consider opening a new office but then hesitates for fear that they'll get locked into something that might not be, you know, something they want to get locked into forever?
Through the chair, I guess I'm not concerned just because at this point we have a multi-year record of net positive revenue and many DMVs and different circumstances, and I think the folks at DOA can probably model out pretty well what's a requisite population to support in a net positive way DMV operations in a given community. And of course we have DMVs that have operated in rural areas and they can look to those experiences. So I think it's just going to be important to look at the data and, you know, make a good decision.
Thank you.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify for the record that I do know what's going on in the Homer DMV because that's my community. And asserting that the commissioner is going to arbitrarily close it or has closed it is on shaky ground because the employees have been out for medical reasons, and the Soldotna DMV has been supplementing those appointments the best that they can. They've been trying to fulfill the needs there. So I recommend looking into the current situations of DMVs because the Homer office is open for business, and I've had to clarify that numerous times in my community because of expert testimony has created a lot of confusion. And I commend the employees there, and I wish them full health, and you know that we also had in our budget subcommittee, the testimony from the director of DMV services said that they will honor the request, the will of the legislature in our budget decision. So having this as the entire premise of your bill does not give me confidence that this is a sound decision when I believe that we need to have the yearly flexibility in our budget process to be able to assist the administration in deciding the future of DMVs. Thank you.
We'll call that a comment. And seeing no other... Oh, okay. Okay, absolutely. We'll make this the final round. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor. And I keep staring at this section one and trying to picture what, you know, what could happen and what could happen. And I guess if you had an existing DMV that was operating, but for some reason they needed a contract to staff it for this, Representative Vance kind of was hitting on the edges of what I'm thinking, would this prevent them from being able to staff a position, because it says for operation? So I'm wondering if there's another little trap there that could we can't do a short-term hire to fill a gap because of this wording. So there might be some work to do in there.
Thanks to the chair. We'll check with Ledge Legal to make sure that that wasn't sort of an unintended consequence of the drafting.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, I also wanted to add a clarifying comment for the record. Certainly, there's money being appropriated through our budget process right now to maintain the existing DMV offices and leases and rent and so forth. And I just wanted to point out that something can cost money and also be revenue positive. And that doesn't need to be false information, because those both can be true. Thank you.
Noted. Any further questions? Representative Story?
Thank you, Chair Christ Tompkins. I mostly wanted to make a comment, not a question. I think when administration, anyone looks at closing and certain services, you have to always look at it from fairness points of view and access. And I appreciate Representative Fields bringing this bill to our attention and seeing if this would be a proper way to go forward. Thank you.
Well, seeing as we're squarely in comment phase, there are maybe a couple of questions that we can get confirmation from legislative legal, but I think sort of given what I'm sensing from community members, I'm going to set an amendment deadline for this bill Monday, close of business next week, Monday, for members to submit any amendments. And we'll set aside the legislation for now. Thank you, Representative Fields and Mr. Walsh, for the presentation. And that takes us to the second item on today's agenda, but because I think we're doing a PowerPoint swap, I'm going to take a brief at ease for us to queue up the slide deck. Readies. PM. We've got the slide deck queued up. Welcome, Mr. Crocker, staff to Speaker Stutes, and this is House Bill 63, first hearing. The floor is yours.
Good afternoon, through the chair. My name is Kerry Crocker, staff to Representative Stutes. Apologize, the representative got pulled away. But before you today is HB 63, establishing Alaska Marine Highway System Operations Board. I apologize about the large quantity of documents that I provided the committee, but I thought it was appropriate that you saw all the studies on the Alaska Marine Highway over the years. And we won't be going over them today, but I thought it was important information for the committee to have. The first ferry, the MV Chilkat, started operation in 1957 before Alaska was a state. When Alaska became a state in 1959, the MV Chilkat became the Alaska's first state-owned ferry. That same year, Alaskans approved an $18 million bond to build ferries and docks throughout Alaska. In 1963, the Alaska Marine Highway was established. By 1984, some 20 years after Marine Highway operation started, Governor Sheffield established a task force to assess operations, a structure and rate system in the face of growing demand and reduced operating budget. It was determined that the system was archaic and that there was definitely a lack of continuity of purpose. The task force suggested that AMHS consider a change in the management structure to help provide business directive and for the system to succeed.
And I just want to note that I grew up looking at the Chilkat and sick as Elias in Harbor, although may it now rest in peace. I think it floundered in a windstorm in Bellingham last year.
Meanwhile, while the management structure was lacking without a proper business structure in place, we saw new boats being built throughout the 60s and 70s, and then several decades without any construction of any new ships. This lack of planning and direction was one of the biggest challenges that our Marine Highway faces today, with out of 7 out of our 10 vessels are more than 40 years old currently. And out of this screen, currently the Malaspina sits at the dock and requires a tremendous amount of money to be able to use her again. In your package today, we included a memorandum from 1989 that I thought was particularly important. It was from Mark Hickey, who was the commissioner of the Department of Transportation. And in the memo, he says many things, but one of the most moving things is the combination of the inability to articulate the comprehensive system plan and the real or perceived impacts resulting from the growing budget dilemma has served as a primary impetus for many to support the establishment of a public authority as a way to address the existing problems. Now, this bill doesn't make a public authority, but I thought that was important that in 1989, that was a discussion. 32 years, excuse me, since the 80s, we returned to the same question over and over again. In 84, we had a task force that looked at the Marine Highway, and they determined there needed to be a management structure change. In 16, we had Southeast Conference. They did a study with the Lieutenant Governor and the Governor's Office, and Elliott Bay Design Group and the McDowell Group, and they found the same thing. There needed to be a long-term management strategy and planning. In 2020, again, we had the governor appointed his reshaping committee, and they determined that management needed to be restructured and that privatization was probably not feasible. And as early as March 10th, we have the headline from Alaska, from the Juneau Empire, with the same, you know, lack of planning hampers the Marine Highway. One of the recommendations from the reshaping work group commissioned by Governor Dunleavy was to create a Marine Operations Board or a ferry commission. The Marine Operations Board of Directors would have the ability to suggest, assess marine business and procurement practices, enhance revenue, reduce costs, and have the experience and the knowledge in marine personnel management. SB 63 replaces the current Marine Transportation Advisory Board with a smaller 9-member Marine Transportation Operation Board. The board would be composed of Alaska Marine Highway Director, 2 members chosen by the Speaker of the House, 2 members chosen by the Senate President, and 4 members chosen by the Governor. One of the members from the Governor would be an Alaska Native organization or a tribe to represent the community served by Alaska Marine Highway, and one of them would be from a Maritime Union. The bill also requires the Commissioner of DOT to incorporate the board's recommendation in the long-range comprehensive transportation plan for the state. Be happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Crocker. Questions from the committee for Mr. Crocker. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pardon me. I just want to understand a little bit more kind of the story that's being told between the two slides with the multiple task force, task forces to look into this. So I've always sort of deferred this to the coastal legislators because it's more of an issue for you guys. So basically what exists right now, it sounds like it's just, you know, the same thing that people keep coming back to is structurally it's not sound, and so it, you know, it's not that the people themselves couldn't be doing something better, but it's sort of like the infrastructure as it is doesn't allow them to have any influence over the management and operations, and that seems to be the missing component of like transitioning from one to the other kind of board.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. The board composition as it exists right now is a 12-member board appointed by the governor, and it's mainly geographical. There's not a lot of qualifications. It's not that they don't do a good job making recommendations. It seems like the recommendations aren't necessarily always followed. And we thought by incorporating the Marine Highway Director into that board and having marine professionals on that board and requiring the commissioner to incorporate that into the plan would give the board some more authority within DOT.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Tompkins. Through the chair, I am wondering if it is the correct date, January 1st, 2022, that this would go into effect, and if so, why not the beginning of this new fiscal year, July 1st, 21.
Through the chair, Representative Story, we thought that would be the best, give the current board, give everybody an opportunity to choose a board and time for transition. We thought that would be the appropriate amount of time.
Another question through the chair. I was wondering why in this bill we have a division we have a different head of the committee. The governor's bill has the commissioner, and this bill has Captain Falvey, I believe. Could you explain why this bill you feel would be better to go with the other director?
Through the chair, Representative Story. Yes, we thought it was be more appropriate to have the director on there, so he'd be more intimately involved with the day-to-day operations of the Marine Highway. We thought his input would be better used by the board. We figured the commissioner flies more of the 30,000 foot level, and that the board would be more involved in the short-term and long-term strategy.
Thank you.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So I see in Section 5 that there's a requirement, in essence, that members of the board will not miss more than two meetings in a year without, you know, being excused. And I mean, that seems to make sense to me. But I see that you've kind of exempted the head of the Division of Marine Transportation from that requirement. And I was wondering, is there an expectation that that's kind of more of an honorary thing and that person just doesn't really need to be there? I know in some other statutes, I think I've seen where it can be that person or their designee, and either could fulfill that requirement to make sure somebody's there. What's the intention with regard to that person's participation?
To the chair, Representative Eastman, the reason the wording is like that is because he is appointed by the governor, and it would be necessarily, he could have a designee there, but would be required to be there, so we couldn't remove him unless the governor decided to remove him. So he works at the pleasure of the governor, couldn't be necessarily removed from the board just for lack of attendance because he works for the governor, I guess is the simplest way to explain it. Ledge Legal required us to exempt him.
Follow up. And has there been any thought to maybe opening that up a little bit so that it could be that person or their authorized designee?
There has been no, through the chair, Representative Eastman, there's been no thought, but I think that something would definitely entertain for sure.
Thank you. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Crocker, looking through the roles or the skill sets that are listed here, I noticed that there's nothing about continuous improvement. You know, the whole slate of quality management knowledge and understanding that allows organizations to transform without causing undue upset or, you know, the negative effects of change. Is that possibly something that would help achieve the mission that the bill is seeking?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, absolutely. That is, I mean, that could be something that could be incorporated, and I think that it would benefit the bill for sure.
Follow up, but that's something I'd like to discuss offline if we could. Thank you.
Yeah. Sounds like it could be a findings and intent section, perhaps. But yeah, I think everybody would like to see some continuous improvement in the ferry system. Before going to you, Representative Eastman, Representative Vance, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question on kind of just understanding the language on the title going from Alaska Marine Transportation Advisory Board to Alaska Marine Highway Operations, and why. Why the change in the language? What's the story behind that?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, that was some language that was used in the report from the governor's reshaping committee, and that's where that language came from.
I think I'd just chime in. My own personal perspective is, I think a goal, well, certainly of mine, is that this board is is as empowered as possible. And Operations Board, I think, has just a slightly more forceful frame and presentation than an advisory board. But Representative Vance, a follow-up?
That answered my question, and I do appreciate the language that talks about the short term and the comprehensive long term. I think that's where we're at on where we'd like to be on every policy, but definitely with this one, because it's obviously very needed. So as I look through this, I do have one more question that is an actual question, and it's concerning the membership. And I'm reading through on page 2, the board is comprised of 9 members, and it has 2 public members, you know, with different expertise appointed by the governor, but then on 5 and 6, 2 public members, you know, similar experience, but it says appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who serves at the pleasure of the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and then again it has that language for the Senate. And why the difference in just being appointed by the presiding officers and the governor to adding the language on 5 and 6 that says who serves at the pleasure of the presiding officers? How would that look for those members?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, the reason for that language is typically a board would, you know, the board as a whole would work at the pleasure of the governor. And we thought if the presiding officers or the respective bodies were appointing these people to this board, that they shouldn't be able to be removed by the governor. We thought they would work at the pleasure of the speaker or the Senate president. So it's just so they can't be arbitrarily removed. We get a new governor, he doesn't like the board, he can't just get rid of the board. And also the same would apply for the presiding officers, can't just remove the entire board. And I think the goal of the bill in general is to create less turnover and more long-term planning. And that's the hope with the diversity in the board.
Thank you.
I have a quick question before doing a second pass with other members' questions. Mr. Crocker, do you know what precedent exists for board and commission appointments from presiding officers of either body presently in statute?
Presently in statute, I'm not aware of too many. The one that comes off the top of my head is the, of course, the redistricting board. You know, they have appointees from both bodies. We have asked for an opinion on that matter from LegLegal, but we haven't got one yet.
In an opinion that would include precedents of
yes,
presiding officers.
Yes, that's correct.
If you could share that with the committee upon receipt, that would be welcome.
Absolutely.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Through the chair. So, 2 things. So, on the requirement dealing with vacancies, I see on page 3 that there's a requirement that if any vacancy on the board arises, that someone needs to be appointed within 30 days. And I just wanted to, you know, point out, you know, there are times when we may not have, in fact, at least twice in the last, you know, couple of years, we haven't had a presiding officer for 30 or more days. And so just wanted to see maybe we should consider a different way of requiring that, unless we're okay with, you know, that vacancy extending beyond 30 days. Any comments on that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I don't really have any comments on that. I definitely, that's a point well made. I think the bill sponsors are comfortable with that language.
Thank you. Follow up?
Follow up.
So I see in section 9 that there's a repealer, and I guess I'm used to seeing those repealers take place at the very end of the bill, so it seemed a little bit odd that it was in section 9 as opposed to section 10. But I noticed that what's being repealed is the requirement that there be, you know, a board member to from areas of the state that aren't directly served by the Marine Highway. Of course, my district would fall into that category currently, and so you know, we might have someone from my district, you know, on the board currently, but that require that seat, in effect, is being taken away. Can you speak to why?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we don't believe the seat is necessarily being taken away because they could be appointed by either presiding officer or the governor if they met the requirements of the experience. It doesn't require them to be from any particular area, just an Alaska resident, I believe, and to have the experience necessary to be on the board. So nothing would preclude the governor from appointing someone from Fairbanks or from any area in the state.
Follow up. So, but again, today we have a requirement in statute that we want that diversity from someone not, you know, being served by the Marine Highway, and I can see that, you know, there's some, maybe some value in having that diversity. So you recognize that, in essence, the state is, you know, funding or subsidizing the highway. So everyone's, you know, pitching in, and maybe it would help the conversations and the decisions being made by the board to have that diversity. But why are we choosing to eliminate that requirement?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman. I mean, we are eliminating that requirement for the entire board. So that, you know, it limits it from all geographical areas. So I don't think we're singling anybody out. And then we're enabling the presiding officers and the governor to appoint from any geographical area. So, again, I don't think it's necessarily removing one. If someone is from Willow and has the appropriate background, they could certainly be appointed to the board still.
Thank you.
Representative Clayman.
Just a curiosity on the board membership. Oftentimes we'll see the head of a enterprise not sitting on the board, but kind of there to take direction from the board. What's the thinking on having the head of the Division of Marine Transportation on the board rather than consulting with the board but not having a vote?
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, this has come up a number of times, and typically, you're correct, typically in nonprofits, you see the executive director not on the board and following the board's direction. We felt like we needed the buy-in from the director, and we needed the expertise to be on the board, and the board would be more or less directing the commissioner, not necessarily the director.
Thank you.
Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Mr. Crocker, could you walk me through what the reporting is of this commission? So what's the nature of what they report? Who's it reported to? How do we keep line of sight that this board is achieving its mission?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, so they would report annually to the legislature, so probably typically to the House Transportation Committee or the Senate Transportation Committee. They would come and give a presentation and give their report, and it would also, if this bill were to pass, the commissioner in Statute 4442050 is required to develop a statewide comprehensive intermodal long-range transportation plan for the state. And I included that statute in your documents. And they would, the commissioner would be required to adopt the recommendations of this committee into that plan. And in that statute, it tells how that plan is held. And the plan copies are maintained on file and as a public document in the office of the commissioner, and developed a list of projects that are scheduled for design and construction. I mean, it goes on and on and on. It's very detailed. So they would also give those, the commissioner would give that update to the legislature once a year, I'm assuming.
Hello?
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair. I guess what I'm wondering, we think of the marine highway system, the ferries, as critical infrastructure, and there is, in my opinion, a widespread acknowledgement that we need improvement, we need structural changes, we need that. Would there be benefit, and I think there would be, but asking you, would there be benefit in having a bit more of a pointed progress reporting structure essentially part of an improvement plan that was actually, you know, we identify targets and we're progressing and we're identifying where we're not hitting targets, et cetera. I'm wondering if a more detailed, more robust plan might not be more aligned with the mission of trying to drive a high initial rate of improvement and then sustain that and follow on with additional incremental improvement.
Through the chair, Representative Goffman, one of the problems we run into when creating this board is the board can only have so much authority constitutionally. If we try to give it too much authority, we run into constitutional issues with the governor and the administration. So we're not able to give, for lack of a better term, we're not able to give it a bunch of teeth and direct and just, you know, say you will direct the Marine Highway and Department of Transportation to do these things, because they don't necessarily work for the governor or their department administration. Legal has advised us that we can't make it that pointed.
I just add, and for the committee's reference, and many of you are already familiar with this, there's the notion of a public corporation, which would be like a fully and formally and empowered governance structure, which I personally am supportive, and I believe the sponsor is also supportive as well, but that's a whole different enchilada, which we're not, you know, digging into right now. But, I mean, in this structure, I think there actually would be room for, like, a findings and intent section in which the board could, the legislature could say, you know, it's the intent for this operations board to set performance goals like fare box recovery ratio or traffic and passenger count data or service weeks per year. And, I mean, I think everybody, all stakeholders, would appreciate
reliability,
that.
Reliability. Standard metrics.
Exactly. So that's maybe something that we can think about, and I think it's a point well made.
Happy to discuss that.
Thank you.
Other questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins. I guess my question has to do with the timeline again of starting January 1st, 2020. And my concern is I feel like I would like a product sooner. I know that the Alaska Advisory Board, Marine Transportation Advisory Board, is, you know, looking at this now and working. But again, to me, the quicker that it can be appointed and happen in like in July and get things going, it would just help move the system along quicker. And so that's just on my mind.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Story, I appreciate the comment, and I'm sure we would entertain looking into that.
Great. Well, seeing no further questions, appreciate the presentation, Mr. Crocker, and likewise, I'm going to set an amendment deadline of next Monday, 5 o'clock, for amendments on this piece of legislation, and we'll communicate the amendment deadline for both pieces of legislation to the committee by email as well. So we'll hold the legislation for now. Thank you very much, Mr. Crocker, for taking the time and presenting the legislation. Quick housekeeping item, as previously noted, if possible, if members could advise me if they will be out of town, that will help sort of management of ensuring we have quorum to conduct business. And I know some of you have been good about doing that. I think there's a broader issue of excused absences through proper protocols, but anyway, just trying to be able to conduct business and have some certainty and reliability in doing so. So any advance notice would be much appreciated. And for Thursday, we have three bills, House Bill 118, which is a third hearing. This is on a prisoner access to internet and recidivism reduction. There were no amendments received by the amendment deadline, House Bill 118, so we'll take that up for final consideration before the committee. And then we also have the two governor's bills, House Bill 106 and House Bill 103, also scheduled for Thursday. Yes, Representative Tarr, question.
Just a question. The two bills we heard today, we just set the amendment deadline, but we didn't do the public testimony.
Plan to set public testimony for the second hearing.
Okay, so that maybe is maybe on Tuesday or something.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, so we'll notice public testimony. I generally schedule public testimony not on the first hearing, but on a second or subsequent hearing.
Okay.
So my thinking is the public has the opportunity to sort of hear the bill and the back and forth, and then have the ability to testify with a slightly sort of more informed vantage.
Okay, and I just asked specifically on the DMV one because I was just curious. That would might have informed my thinking on any amendments, so that's why I asked on this particular one. So we'll just wait and see what people say, but that was what I was thinking.
Absolutely. Well, we can always be flexible, and you know, if there's new and notable information presented in testimony, we want to be responsive to that, so can make it work. So that concludes the business. Thank you, Sophia and Tom, the LIO, and our fearless committee aide, Jeff Stepp, for facilitating today's meeting. And at 4:21 p.m., we are adjourned.